bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down real life, I'm fighting in a far-from-dive key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down real life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on lightresistanceradio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. I want to play today a very special recording for you about the vicious, surreptitious attack by Israel on the USS Liberty. And this is a called the Six-Day War Massacre. The USS Liberty veterans reveal the truth about the Israeli attack. That was way back in 1967. And this is excellent. And I'm going to turn the show over to this great show performance here.
Our butts were on the deck, our backs were against the bulkhead, and when the torpedo hit, it blew us.
Who was on board? Joining me today are three brave veterans who survived the Israeli attack. And it's an honor to welcome them. We'll start with Mr. William Michael LeMay, known to his friends as Mickey. He was 22 years old, second-class electrician's mate in charge of the Liberty's electrical department. Mickey, welcome. Glad to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, sir. Mr. Robert Allen Scarborough joined the Navy at age 21 in 1966. He was a communications technician on the USS Liberty. Bob, welcome. Glad to have you here on today's show.
Thank you very much.
An honor to have you here.
Appreciate it.
And Mr. Larry Brown, is also here with us. Larry was a second-class communications technician. After the USS Liberty massacre, Larry served 40 years at the NSA. Larry, welcome. Glad to have you here,
sir. Thank you, Rick, and thank you, True News, for all your support today and through the week for all of us.
Yes, sir.
It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege to have you gentlemen here. And if you did not see our episode yesterday, please watch part one and get this two-part show out to everybody. Tell everybody about it. The whole world needs to know the truth about the Liberty. But the reason that these men are here, along with Phil Turney and Dave Gahari, is that there's a new book that tells the story. It's titled Erasing the Liberty. And it's the battle to keep alive the memory of Israel's massacre on the USS Liberty, Erasing the Liberty. And the website for the book is erasingtheliberty.com. And so this is the true story of these men, which has never been told. It's never been told. This is the most suppressed story in America, other than the truth about 9/11. And we had American servicemen who were killed. We had nearly 200 wounded, severely wounded, and the ship was practically blown to pieces. And yet the American government ordered Washington, originating from the White House and the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and the President, Lyndon Baines Johnson, ordering the U.S. military to stand down and not rescue these men while they were under attack by Israel. Admiral McCain, the father of Senator John McCain, played a major role in this story, covering up the truth. And the truth has been suppressed. As we heard yesterday from Phil Turney, he was ordered by an admiral never to talk, threatened with imprisonment, even death, if he ever told a relative about what happened on June 8, 1967. It's shocking. It's just absolutely shocking. The Liberty is the most decorated American naval ship in history of this country for a single action, and every American citizen should know about what happened, and we should be honoring the veterans who survived that massacre, and it was a massacre.
Can we show the audience, just to start off right off the bat, the decorations?
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's put that graphic up. Here you go, Rick.
208 Purple Hearts, 1 Medal of Honor, 2 Navy Crosses, 12 Silver Stars, 26 Bronze Stars with Valor, 9 Navy Commendations. And yet your story has been suppressed. It is an outrage. And the only reason it's been suppressed is there's one reason. Because the Israelis don't want the American people to know what happened. What I want you men to do today, what is simply tell our audience what happened, what you saw, what you heard, what you experienced, and how it impacted you. Now, let's see, two of you were CTs, right?
That would be Bob and myself.
You two were communication technicians, all right? And you were in the electrical department, right?
We might want to tell the audience what the CTs were, and there was kind of a division on the boat of, they call them spies. Mm-hmm. They would listen to codes. And the shipmen, is that how would you?
Ship's company.
Right. And the two were kind of separated. There was not fraternization of right. The two. And they kept their distance because.
So you kept the ship running.
Correct.
While these guys were doing their mission.
Correct.
Is that?
Right.
That's right? Okay.
Pretty much.
All right. So and the mission of the ship was to gather intelligence for the U.S. military, right?
Correct.
Primarily the NSA?
Is that yes, that right? Is correct.
It was an NSA ship.
It was our mission was primarily directed by the National Security Agency. That is correct.
And after you left the Navy, you spent 40 years at the NSA.
My overall career was 43 years supporting the National Security Agency. 21 with the Navy, and another 22 as a defense contractor, still supporting the National Security Agency.
Okay. So, which should we start
with? I think Mickey.
All right, Mickey, let's start with you.
Yeah, let's start with that.
What are the first things that you remember on that day, June 8?
Yeah. We had just finished General Quartus. That was practicing for a battle. And we did that on a regular basis. The captain had us practice all the time for a battle. And what it was is my duty station was at the generator, which was just above the engine room, and their entrance into their department was right next to where my duty station was.
Mm-hmm.
We had secured from that, and I was going up to the 04 level. This is a little platform, a deck they called it, mm-hmm. that was four levels above the main deck. And as I was going up the ladder to get on to the fourth level, a jet fighter, which was black, was flying the same direction we were.
Unmarked jet fighter.
Totally black, not a mark on it. I could see the pilot. I couldn't see the face real good, but I saw the pilot on the plane. He was that low and that close to the ship. And we are supposed to report any plane that flies over us, get a record of it. So there was a lieutenant up there, and I turned to him and I said, "Sir, did you see that fighter?" And he says, "No, where is it?" And with that, I walked closer to him, and as I turned around to point at the fighter I saw, another fighter came from the bow to the stern diagonally across us and strafed us. And I looked down and I saw blood coming out of me, every part of my body. I was hit then, and the lieutenant was hit too. He looked just like me. He looked like he had as many holes as I had.
How many wounds did you have?
I still carry 52 pieces of shrapnel in me. They
still
did remove
carry?
Some of them. Yes,
it's
I still
in your body.
Yeah, 52 pieces still. They stopped taking them out because I had four cardiac arrests when I was in Naples, Italy, when they were trying to remove them. So they said leave him in until he's healthy enough, and if they bother him, we'll take him out. But they, luckily for me, it's never bothered me.
And what about the other gentleman?
He was still standing the last I saw him, and I looked at him and I said, "What's going on? I'm getting the heck out of here." And I ran to the ladder, slid down, and went inside the ship at the next deck down. He didn't follow me. They found part of him on the top where I was, and the other half of him was on the deck below. So I'm assuming he was either dead, not fallen, or he was finally killed on the second strafing, maybe, mm-hmm. or the third, or one of the other ones, because he did not follow me. And when I got inside the ship, my left leg had been shattered, and that's when I fell on the deck, and I crawled another deck down into the ship.
But you managed to run despite so many wounds.
Right. Yeah, luckily my body didn't know my leg was shattered and I couldn't stand. It got me into the ship where I felt safe at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I crawled down to the next level down, and as I'm coming around the corner, a shipmate says, "Hey, you hurt?" And I, honest to God, I said, "No, I love crawling on the deck." And we laughed. We really did. Blood everywhere, of course. And he went and got help, got a stretcher for me, and started carrying me down to sick bay. And as we went around the corner, a corpsman came by. He had put a tourniquet on my leg so I wouldn't bleed, wouldn't lose it.
Right.
And the corpsman said, "Get that tourniquet off because we don't want him to lose the leg." And as they put me on the deck, a massive explosion happened just above us, and a rocket came through the overhead. And put a hole in his, I was told, in his wrist. You could just look right through it, and I got a scar here from that same incident. And that was the first time I can remember seeing a cloud. As I was two decks into the ship, I'm looking up, I can see the blue sky. And
you're two decks in,
two decks into
you
the
can
ship,
see blue
and I can
sky.
See blue sky with a little bit of a cloud next to it. Now, it might have been smoke from the fires or what was going on the deck, but I think it was clouds.
What were you thinking at that point?
At that time, I was still okay. We were okay. At that moment, that was when I first started thinking, "Oh, damn it, we're dead." That's right, at that point.
Yeah.
Up till then, I thought we'd be okay.
Did you have any idea, were you thinking, who possibly was attacking?
My feeling was it had to be Egypt or one of them. I assumed Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And had no idea what the planes were or anything like that. and they got me down sick bay. I blacked out a lot in between then and there. I remember laying in the deck in the, woke up, prepared for torpedo attack. I don't remember the torpedo hitting. I remember prepared to abandon ship, thinking, just leave me here. Don't worry about me. Just get yourself off the ship. And then I remember hearing cancel the abandoned ship. And then I was fine.
All right, how about you? What do you remember that day?
I was down in our secure spaces, being a communications technician radioman. I was a 21-year-old second-class petty officer. And I had a day watch that day. So I was setting a position, intercepting Morse code. And as Mickey mentioned earlier, you know, we had a practice general quarters drill just prior to the attack. And my general quarters station was one level above where the torpedo actually entered the ship. So that day, when the skipper came over the 1MC, our internal communication system, and said, general quarters, this is not a drill, I left my position down in the radio research spaces and went up one level to set another position doing my same job. And at that point, I didn't know exactly what was going on up above. I mean, I knew we were under attack, and the first sounds that I'd heard, to me, sounded like someone dragging an anchor chain across the deck. You could hear the rat-a-tat-a-tat, you know, going across the deck, but I'd never heard that before, so I wasn't really sure what it was. When I got to my new position, that one level above, I could actually see the 50 caliber tracer rounds coming through the skin of the ship. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, depending on where those 50 caliber rounds are coming, you know, myself and the other CTs that were in that room could have very easily been killed by a 50 caliber round. When I think Phil Turney may have mentioned yesterday that there were over 5,000 holes in the ship, not counting the 800 plus holes that were, you know, cannon size or you know. So the 50 or the 5,000 rounds that he was talking about were the 50 caliber rounds.
You saw them coming through.
And I actually saw the tracer rounds coming through because it's a white, powdery, you know, line coming through so that they could, I don't know, I guess the targeting that they do just helps provide feedback to them. Mm-hmm. But I remember that. I remember when the skipper came over the 1MC saying, prepare for a torpedo attack. That's when Clyde and I moved over to the frame 51 and our butts were on the deck, our backs were against the bulkhead, and when the torpedo hit, it blew us straight up in the air. Our heads hit the overhead. We both got, you know, concussions. When we came back down to the deck, all of the equipment that were in the metal racks that we'd been sitting at had been jettisoned out of the racks, and it was just strewn all over the floor and the area. We're lucky that, you know, we had been, I guess, jettisoned up to the overhead. It's a wonder that we weren't, you know, beat up worse than we were from those pieces of equipment. We were wearing long sleeve dungarees at the time, and neither one of us knew whether or not we'd been seriously injured in any way. Our first thought, once we collected ourselves, was that we've got all of our shipmates down below in a flooded compartment with a torpedo hit. And so we left the room that we were in and went out to open up the scuttle, mm-hmm. which was a small hole in the hatch leading below decks. and we opened up the scuttle to get the first couple of sailors out, and Clyde Way and Lieutenant John Johnson were there as well. That's when I got detailed to go to the door, the entrance to our compartment, which was a secure area. Only communications technicians with the top secret clearances could get into that space. But John Johnson wanted me to go there and hand out life jackets to everyone that was coming out of the secure area, so that if we had to abandon ship, everyone would have something to keep them afloat until our rescuers came. So that's where I went. They stayed at the hatch in the scuttle to help everyone out of the area below. And I'm going to say 50 or 60 of our sailors that were down in that flooded compartment came out in various states of disarray, I'll say. I mean, they were bloodied, they were maimed, they soaking wet, but they were, you know, it was chaotic to some extent, but they were conscious of what was going on and knew that, you know, we had a job to do. And so they were performing the way they would normally perform. We had to get up to a casualty collection area.
And so what were you thinking at this point? Why, what was happening and who was doing it?
To be honest, Rick, at that point, I wasn't sure. I couldn't imagine who would even attack an American ship out there. It was a Cold War. I knew that it was the fourth day of the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War, but Israel was our ally. So I didn't think it was Israel, and I really didn't think Egypt had the wherewithal to do something like that. I knew that on the first day of the war, the Israeli Air Force had knocked out, you know, the majority of the Egyptian Air Force, so I really didn't think it was Egypt. And I was hoping that it wasn't the Russians, because, you know, that would have started World War III.
Absolutely. So the first wave, how long did that last? What do you recall?
I'm thinking that first air attack, before the torpedo attack, was in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 minutes.
Of nonstop firing?
Yes. The firing and the napalm. There was the strafing, and then another set of jets came in with the napalm. It wasn't the same series of jets that had the napalm. So it was a three-pronged attack, the way I understand it. You had the jets that were doing the strafing and hitting us with rockets and the 50 caliber machine gun fire. Then you had another series of aircraft that came in with the napalm canisters to drop. And then you had the three torpedo boats that came in and launched the five torpedoes at us.
Can you describe that sound of the torpedo going in? Because a lot of people think the torpedo will explode on contact. But it went in first, right?
I don't remember that. I think Bob Scarborough would probably be better to, because he has a clearer recollection of that. I was sitting in a position and I had headphones on.
Well, we can go to Bob.
So Bob, yeah. You tell us, what do you recall that first moment of the attack?
I was in, I'd had the midwatch the night before I slept in. That morning, and so I'd gotten some chow, and we had our, at 1300, we had our GQ drill. So my GQ station was below decks at my position in RR1, which was two decks below the main deck. And so I went there for a GQ practice, and when that was completed, I went back to the our berthing spaces, and we were just sitting around talking, and I heard what sounded like somebody tossing a and full of ball bearings with a piece of glass, except the glass didn't break. Mm-hmm. And that was the sound that, and I knew immediately what it was. It was not good. And all of us, immediately before the GQ alarm went off, we were already headed down to our GQ stations. So I hadn't been topside at all that day. So once I got to my GQ station, we started turning dials and see if we could pick up any kind of communication, which we did. We were, of course, hearts pumping and not knowing what was going on. And a little while later, I guess from the from all the rockets and machine guns or the cannon fire from the aircraft, our equipment started to smoke. So we shut all the equipment down and just waited to see, you know, what was going to happen. And of course, when the torpedo boats arrived, we heard a standby for torpedo starboard side. And so I had a hard hat, so we'd all get down on the floor or on the deck. And I was near a bulkhead on the passageway side, I lay there and and the torpedo never came, so we kind of got back up, started talking again, and waiting to see what else was going to happen. The 1MC, the announcement was made on the 1MC again to stand by for a torpedo attack starboard side, and eventually I heard brace for torpedo starboard side. So about that time, lying on the deck, saying a few prayers, I heard a thump, and just a second later, the explosion. Of course, the deck heaved, and I was up in, I hit the overhead as well, and slammed back on the deck. I don't know how long I was, probably unconscious. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But I do remember when I stood up, I could see fires. And it was strange to me. I was wondering why I could see fires when there's bulkheads there. And I didn't know until we got into dry dock and I went back in there that the bulkheads were obliterated. They were gone. And the one I was next to was just peeled right up into the overhead over my head. So it was a wonder I'm still here. I lay on the deck, and I felt water around me. And my ears, I couldn't hear a thing for a while, and it was still pitch black. I started to get up, and by the time I got up, I was walking ankle deep in water. Didn't realize the bulkhead was gone, and that's actually where the location of the ladder going topside was. So instead, I walked down to the entrance to the RR1, and by that time I was probably up to my knees in water, and walked out into the passageway. There was a doorway into I guess that was PNR.
Yeah.
Processing reporting, where there was a guy with his foot caught in that door, because the onrushing water, there's a lip that comes up from the deck. His foot was caught in there, so I helped him push the door back against the water pressure, and we both got out. By that time, we were starting to tread water as the ship rolled back down and took on more water. By the time we got to the end of the passageway, we were swimming, and soon after that, I found a pipe in the overhead, and so I just hung on to a pipe in the overhead, and the hatch was closed. The scuttle was not open. I wondered why the scuttle wasn't open, and we're getting to the point where we had about 18 inches of breathing space left, and I could hear a sailor on the deck above with a wrench trying to undo these large bolts that held the hatch down. The hatch was about 6 feet across by 2.5 or 3 feet. So I had to go all the way around and undo all those bolts in order to open the hatch for us to get up the ladder. So finally the hatch did open, and we made our way across the passageway to the ladder, and got up to the next deck, and lo and behold, there's my savior, Larry Bowen, holding a life vest, and so I went up topside.
How many men were in there with you?
I have no idea. It was dark. There was a battle lantern there, but it was very dim, so you could just.
You know how many got out alive? They don't recall.
I don't know. I don't know. We all.
All for 25, whatever the count was. Yeah.
So a lot of the casualties happened with the torpedo attack, because mm-hmm. That's where the impact happened. That's where a lot of men were down there, and either the impact of the torpedo, drowning. There's all sorts of ways they could have, but we'll get into this later when there was only certain men who could go down there, mm-hmm. and when they got to port to Malta, unfortunately their clearance deemed them the only ones who could go down there and retrieve the bodies. So we'll get there, but I don't know.
Yeah. So, all right, so that's the first wave. Then what do you recall about the second wave? Were you, the torpedo was the second, right?
Yeah.
All right.
That's correct.
So first the jets were strafing, and then... Right. And then
the torpedo both. Torpedoes.
And then was the napalm the last?
No, the napalm came,
was the second.
It was the second.
Napalm, yeah. Okay. Right.
The torpedo, and then it was kind of get everybody together, find the wounded, and find out if you're the sink. They didn't know if the boat was going to sink.
That's correct. I went to up on the main deck, and there was a lot of us, a collection of us that were below or in the where the torpedoed spaces were, and so there was so much shrapnel on the deck that I was wearing rather regular dress navy shoes with leather soles, and the shrapnel was sticking in the bottom of my shoes so bad every time I stood up I would slide down toward the water, and the water actually was on the edge of the main deck at that time, and I guess from where the ship would roll back down into the water, and so I stayed on top of since this was an old freighter, there were some caps put on top of where the holds were originally. So we were kind of sitting on that, and we stayed there for a while, and somebody said the torpedo boats were returning and to go, and so we headed up into the forecastle. The forecastle is the front on the bow of the ship, and so we went inside the forecastle, and I think I passed out on the floor there for I don't know how long.
When did the three of you become aware that the aggressor was Israel?
Late. For me it was after all the action took place on the deck where because I was unconscious for a while there, so I don't. When did I come aware? I guess I was told after that earlier or later.
Was
that
it
evening.
Before the rescue ships came? The Davis.
The rescue ships didn't come until the next morning.
So everyone was talking about it. Who was it? And then you guys were okay.
Yeah, you, Larry?
Yeah, I knew about it. One of my tertiary jobs, I guess, was I was sent back to the fantail, the rear of the ship, the stern, to be the phone talker, and I was back there because the original phone talker had been shot up very badly and seriously wounded during the first wave, and he's still to this day he's alive,
but I think he's had somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 mm-hmm. surgeries.
Yeah, 40.
And God bless him. He's still alive because God has a mission for us to get this story
the
out.
The quality of his life yep. was really yep. diminished well, because of what Israel did.
We call him Superman.
Yep, we do. And anyway, on that afternoon, I saw an aircraft coming from the starboard side of the ship from Tel Aviv, and I reported that to the bridge. And at about the same time, I saw the three torpedo boats who had been stationed back on the horizon. I saw their wakes coming back towards the ship. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, other than the fact that they were headed in our direction, because I could see the wakes, but when they got closer, I saw that those torpedo boats had Star David flags on them. So I knew at that point, an hour to an hour and a half into the attack, that it was, Israel that was doing the attacking.
Do you remember what your reaction was when you came to that realization that a U.S. naval ship was under attack by Israel?
I do. At the time, the first thing in my mind was I better off staying on the ship, or would I be, better off taking my chances in the water, in the shark-infested waters? Mm-hmm. But, I needed to be on the ship and relaying information to the bridge about what was about to happen.
Sure.
And I thought I heard the skipper, relay, prepare for another torpedo attack. And then I think somebody said, prepare to repel boarders. So that might have been when the aircraft, which turned out to be a helicopter, that may have been the aircraft that came in with the commandos. I don't know. I'm under treatment now. I suppressed all of this for almost 50 years because I stayed working for the National Security Agency for 40 years total.
So you're at a stage of a life where you're just, for the first time, starting to verbalize what happened.
That's correct. I've suppressed all of this. I've kept it internal. I've not told anyone this story because, as Phil Turney mentioned yesterday, we were threatened. We were threatened while we were on board ship, and when I got transferred back to the United States before I got my next set of orders, I had the lieutenant commander that was giving me my orders reaffirming the fact that I could never speak about the USS Liberty incident, that they were calling it, to my family, my congressmen, the media, no one. They threatened us with imprisonment and fines, and of course, being in the Naval Security Group and then a defense contractor, I needed my clearances in order to support my family. So I didn't retire until 2008, and I never provided any kind of insight to anyone. I didn't participate in the Liberty Veterans Association or anything because I didn't want to say anything or do anything that might get me in trouble.
Have you experienced any kind of repercussions since you've started speaking out?
Not yet. I mean, I've been trying now for the past couple of years to support my shipmates and be actively involved in speaking with congressmen and writing letters and trying to get resolutions passed in various states to honor our fallen shipmates and get the truth out. That's been the mission of our Liberty Veterans Association since we organized back in 1980.
Larry, because you held this in for 50 years, how did that affect you personally?
Emotionally, it's been very, very hard on me. I didn't realize how much it had been affecting me because I became kind of a workaholic. Everyone handles these things differently. I didn't realize I was depressed and having anxiety attacks. I was having nightmares and I was having flashbacks and things. I still, to this day, see my shipmates, you know, bodies that I saw when I was on the first recovery team going down into the spaces once we got into Malta. Those images are as vivid today as they were 52 years ago, and that's something you don't get over even through, you know, treatment. It's going to be there. So it's 2 years ago, Rick, I couldn't talk to you or Matt without breaking down. But I wasn't on any kind of medication. I wasn't going through any kind of therapy. For the past two and a half years, I have been on medication and going through therapy, and it's allowing me now to express myself a little better. I still break down.
So had it build up that it came to a crisis in your life that you knew you had to get help, you had to release this, you had to get some.
In 2017, at our 50th reunion, I went to that, and earlier that year, I had started seeing a VA psychiatrist. And in a period of about 6 months, I lost 40 pounds. And I was a shaken man. I didn't feel, or I didn't know that I was having a problem.
Mm-hmm.
My two brothers and I went on a fishing trip, and they were talking amongst themselves, like, what is happening to our brother? And my younger brother asked me point blank, Larry, you would tell us if something was wrong. I think they thought I had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think I'm okay. And my younger brother was the one that told me that he too had gone through a depression, and he told me to go see my doctor, and I did. And they immediately diagnosed me, so I immediately started treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the smartest thing I ever did.
What really surprised me from talking to these gentlemen is you, as someone who's not, like, for me, I would figure that there'd be parades when they came home. And within that, they could share their story, talk about what they went through. And in that process, you can tell your story. But I think the crime here, as many crimes that happened, was the suppression of these men, where they weren't allowed to talk to their family members. What they did when they got back, they dispersed these men around the world, so they were never together. So just now, like, Larry is just coming to wanting to tell his side of the story, which is so important, because even if they wanted to, the media wasn't even going to cover this.
That's right. Well, you have right here.
So here
is a Life magazine. Whose copy is this? Is yours, Bob? So Life magazine. From what,
June 23rd, 1967. Open it up. Go ahead.
Before you do that, who got the front cover?
Yeah.
The IDF.
Mm-hmm.
The IDF, the Israeli Defense Force soldier, is the hero here on Life magazine, 1967. You had to go to what page to find mention of the Liberty?
In the middle here, look what it says, unexplained casualty. USS Liberty.
On page what?
29.
Page 29. And Time says it's an unexplained casualty of the war.
If we can have our control room go through a couple of images we have of the ship.
Okay.
I don't think our audience even understands what the ship looked like, because unfortunately when you ported to Malta, the cover-up really began there of masking the ship and making it new. So let's roll through a couple of these photos if we can. Let's go with the crew photo first, if we can put that up. Does this bring back memories, guys?
That's us having come out of our spaces, our radio research spaces, which were the flooded compartments, and we had been down there, you know, cleaning up, doing body recovery, and
so this was in Malta.
This is in Malta. Yep.
Can we cycle through?
How many days later would that have been?
It took us 6 or 7 days to get to Malta, and then they put us into dry dock. So this would have been probably the 7th day or the 8th day.
I think later.
Yeah.
I think later because it took almost a whole day to get it into dry dock.
That's true too.
Yeah.
Can you just? I hate bringing this up, Larry, Bob, but you guys unfortunately had that clearance where you could go down and recover the bodies, and that was your mission when you got back to Malta. Can you talk about that part of this?
Yeah, I volunteered to go down in the first body recovery effort, partly because one of my best friends was not accounted for in the musters that we had been taken after the attack, and he worked in the processing and reporting office of our area down there, the PNR section. Mm-hmm. So as I'm descending the ladder into the flooded compartment area, I've got a gray battle lantern, Navy battle lantern, and I'm coming down the ladder, and I rotate the lantern to my left, and I see a human body suspended from the overhead, a vertical body suspended from the overhead. And it scared the living daylights out of me. I mean, I thought, as I should have, I thought that if there was anything down there, it would have been laying on the deck or someplace else. But, I mean, it almost looked like here's a living body just right there. And because of the uniform this person was wearing, I knew who it was. And any body that's been in salt water or probably any kind of water for 7 or 8 days is a disfigured, bloated body. And we, as human beings, want to be as respectful as we can for any other human being, especially a deceased human being in this case. We had body bags to use to help bring these shipmates out of that compartment. So there were 3 or 4 individuals in each of our teams that went down there to recover bodies. And so the 4 of us put this man in the body bag and then helped get him back up the ladder to another group of individuals. You saw how many were on the deck out there, to get him back up to another area. Now, I don't know if they were being offloaded to other ships or put into coffins and offloaded. How that was done. I know that the men that were killed on the main decks were being put in the reefer while we were in transit. Second body was on the deck in pieces, and again, being respectful for the individual wasn't a full body, but the main portion of the body and his limbs were close enough to the body that we're confident that we had the majority of that individual in the same bag.
This is somebody's son.
Yes.
This is some American's son.
The third body was the body that I was probably the most concerned about, because it was my friend, Robert Eisenberg. He's a 23-year-old man who was due to complete his Navy enlistment in August of that year. And I wanted to be able to tell his parents and his sister that, you know, how he died, that he died instantly. He caught a piece of shrapnel in the chest, and so he didn't drown. He was, you know, he was doing his job. Mm-hmm. He was a Russian linguist, but he spoke three languages besides English. Mm-hmm. He was a Jewish man, so he spoke Hebrew, he spoke French, and he spoke Russian. His primary mission for us would have been probably Russian. I mean, that's what he went to school for, as a cryptologic technician. But Bob, I recognize, even though he was bloated and disfigured, and after that, I had satisfied myself, and I wanted then to do whatever I could to ensure that I could accompany his body back to Minnesota where his family lived, and the Navy wouldn't let me do that. Again, they wanted to keep it under wraps, and they said...
You never got a chance to talk to his family?
Just in the past couple of years, I've been able to reach out to his nephew on Facebook, and have been in contact with his nephew, who wanted to know about his Uncle Bob. And I've sent them pictures of the ship and memorabilia about the ship, and they've thanked me, and I've told him and his wife about, you know, how he died and died honorably, you know, given his life for his country, and they've been very appreciative, and so it's given me some sense of closure, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it would have meant a lot more if I could have been able to go back and tell his mom and dad.
The emotional pain that you're going through right now at this stage of your life, would you say, is it primarily from the trauma of the attack, or the trauma of the rescue, the cleanup of the victims?
I think it's actually the trauma of the rescue and the cleanup. It's, yeah, you know, the attack, there's so much adrenaline rushing through your body, and you're somewhat prepared for what you have to do, but dealing with another human being, and especially in the conditions that you see, you know, I mean, I just...
That's what you can't erase.
No, you can't. And those images are so vivid that you just... that. I don't know how to explain it other than, you know, at times, you know, God has made it so that my mind blocks some of that out, and I thank Him for that. But then I wake up and have these nightmares, and I just, you know, a lot of times after I've had a session with my doctor, I'll go back and I'll get a migraine headache from that. because of the pressure, maybe this is a release of pressure, I'm not sure which. But.
So, Rick, we have a picture of Mickey actually being lifted out of the Liberty. Can we put that up, guys? That's actually Mickey right there. When's the last time you saw that photo?
Oh, I see it on a regular basis. It's in my phone.
I would put it there, too. So this is Mickey. Mickey was transported off the Liberty to the Davis?
To America.
Yes. Which was a huge ship, right?
It's an aircraft carrier.
Yes. Can you tell us about that part? Because I know it was a very emotional leaving.
Yeah, they brought us up to the main deck from the mess decks. And as they were pulling me out, I was in charge of the electrical department, so the captain and Lieutenant Golden came over to me and said, my men had done the job admirably, meaning they did what we did so we wouldn't lose power. Then after that, I remember they hoisted me into a helicopter. And as they were pulling me in, the person in the plane said, we'll take one more after this one. And after that, I was actually unconscious for 7 days. So I actually didn't know Israel attacked us until I came to on the America a week later. Wow. That was when I finally heard that it was Israel that attacked us.
Obviously, you've had to deal with the pain of the shrapnel, over 50 pieces in your body today, still carrying it. What about the emotional pain, the emotional baggage? How's it affected you, Mickey?
That, I think I shut down. I worked on for, well, when the Stark, USS Stark was hit with that rocket back in the 80s, I think 83, 84, somewhere around there, I suppressed everything. And matter of fact, I shut down feelings totally. I wouldn't cry no matter what. I had gotten so crazy at times that on my ride home from work that I would say I'd never cry if one of my kids died. That's how strong I wanted to control it. But when the Stark was hit, that was the end of it for me. I lost all control. And I had to end up actually going to the Vietnam Veterans. What was called Vietnam? For psychological help.
Sure.
And just couldn't hold it back anymore, and feelings started coming out, and now I can't stop crying anymore. I can see a cute dog and I'll cry. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Rick, Mickey was sent to Germany to have operated. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I went from the America to Naples, Italy, the naval hospital there, where they put us on the top floor and actually secured it. Nobody could get to that floor to talk to us about anything. I didn't realize that at the time, but later on I did. And then I went, maybe 3 weeks or a month later, they transferred me from there to Germany and to the hospital, the Army hospital in Germany. And they put me in a room with a ward of 20 bunks, but maybe 12 or 15 men were in it. And within 5 minutes, they took me out of that ward and put me in a private room. And as they got me in there and all set up, an officer came in, and that was my first incident of the cover-up. The officer told me, your name is Smith, and if anybody ever comes in and asks you about the USS Liberty, I'm ordering you to tell them nothing. You know nothing at all about the Liberty. So that was my first experience that there was a cover-up. But actually, a couple of years ago, I gave a talk at a church